The date is August 21st, 1998, and we're watching Blade. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me is the Blade to my Abraham Whistler.
Wow, I got top billing. I'm Colin Stewart.
You bet you did. So, we're celebrating Black History Month. The four episodes that we release in the month of February are featuring Black leads, just to highlight, do something a little bit differently. So this week we are looking at Blade, and we decided we wanted to bring in a special guest. So we have with us the host of the Frankfully Honest podcast, which is a fun little short format podcast that I suggest everyone goes and checks out. Frank Driscoll. Frank, welcome.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Colin. It's great to be here. I mean that.
Glad to have you.
Do you want to do your usual introduction to your own podcast? Do your little throat clear and mic tap?
Yes. I do that for good luck. Yeah, okay. I do that because my desk is wooden here, so I want to do it for good luck. So, okay.
Right on.
Hope that brings us some good vibes here. Hopefully that goes well.
So, Frank, we're talking Blade, and when I reached out to you, you said you have never seen Blade, but you are a big fan of movies, and you are a big fan of the Family Guy, which is something that I definitely appreciate. But, yeah, Blade, you've never seen it.
No, I have not seen it once. I know of it, and my brother has seen it, and I didn't know that much about it. I knew it was a superhero, Marvel, all that stuff, and, well, it's kind of hard for me to see it when I was young, because I was about a month old when it came out, so but it was that. But no, I did have a heck of a time trying to watch it, though, because my brother told me it was available on HBO Max, which it is not. Okay. And he claims he saw it there. Yeah. So I coughed up a couple dollars to watch it.
And, oh, no.
It didn't matter to me. Well, 20 minutes of my time. So.
Well, so this week we are looking back at August 1998 when the movies and theaters were Wrongfully Accused, Dance With Me, Pocahontas 2 Journey to a New World, Air Bud Golden Receiver, and of course, our movie for today, Blade, which earned $155 million on a $45 million budget.
That must have been a week weekend at the box office.
That's a weird lineup, yeah.
And as always, yeah, I've heard of Air Bud, but that could be one of probably like 13 sequels. So.
Yeah, Golden Receiver is for sure a sequel because the original one was just Air Bud. I don't know which sequel this is, like you said. And Pocahontas 2.
Yeah, I didn't realize that Pocahontas 2 had been in theaters. I just would have assumed that was a direct-to-video.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, that one surprised me as well.
Same here.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, as always, just so you're aware, there will be spoilers going forward. So if you don't want Blade, which, again, it came out in 1998, and Frank was only a month old. So, I mean, yeah, statute of limitations is out on this one. But again, if you don't want it to be ruined for you, hit pause, go watch it, then come back and hear what we have to say.
So, the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "The power of an immortal, the soul of a human, the heart of a hero."
Wow, I like that.
Yeah, but that may not be the best description of this movie.
Interesting hearing the heart part.
The heart, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that so much that I'd kind of like to have it put on my tombstone when I die.
But that may not be the best description of this movie, so let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
All right, here we go. They call him the Daywalker. Blade is a half-man, half-vampire, full ass-kicker whose life mission is to rid the world of nightclubbing vampires. When Deacon Frost, leader of the sexy vampire posse, uncovers an ancient prophecy that will allow him to rid the world of Blade, the close-minded cabal of pureblood vampires who despise him, and humanity in general, while also turning him into an all-powerful blood god, it's up to Blade, his old pal Whistler, and their new friend Dr. Karen Jensen to save the day by slicing, burning, and exploding any vampire that gets in their way. That is your 60-second synopsis.
Outstanding. Yeah, I know for me, like with this movie, I was just over 18 when this movie came out, and I remember seeing this one in theaters and being excited by the superhero movie that wasn't a superhero movie, and it was a really neat departure from something like Spider-Man, or even the Batman movies weren't quite as dark as Blade. Colin, this for you, I know you mentioned in our Demolition Man episode that this was the reason that you watched Demolition Man, because you loved Wesley Snipes so much. So what is your history with Blade?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to do the math here. Blade came out 23 years ago-ish, so I would have been 12.
Yeah.
Which actually sounds about right, because I would say Blade, and I mean, it's well-trod on this podcast that I love vampires and all things to do with vampires.
Yeah.
So I would have loved this movie regardless, but Blade, to my memory, is one of the first movies that I would say was my movie. Like, it's one of the first movies that I can remember watching that I thought it looked cool, and I watched it, and I loved it. It wasn't a movie that, previous to that, most of the movies I liked were movies that, you know, my parents watched, or my mom, like, kind of turned me on to, and that kind of stuff.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
So that I would say that kind of sums up my relationship to Blade, is that it was one of the first movies that kind of encapsulated what my taste in movies were.
Okay. Frank, have you ever seen any of the sequels, or like this is your first experience with Blade at all?
This is my first experience. Yeah, okay. I found out there were sequels after I watched the movie.
Yeah.
And I learned something very interesting about the sequels involving Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, man, how did that happen?
Yeah, if you read those before you watched the movie, it's like, well.
It's like, now I have to watch it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Blade 2 is pretty sweet. It's directed by Guillermo del Toro, so that
really makes it, yeah, that it's pretty good as well.
I like Blade Trinity a lot.
I do too. Like, Ryan Reynolds,
yeah.
That was, when Ryan Reynolds was in that was the character that I wanted him to be in Wolverine.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, I think, I honestly feel that Ryan Reynolds owes a lot of his career to Blade Trinity.
Quite possibly.
Even though it wasn't critically all that well received, it definitely was the first real big departure from him being just like the comedy Van Wilder type,
yeah,
movies that he was doing before.
Yeah, that's right. He was created into a bona fide action star at this point.
Yeah. Like, without Blade Trinity, there's no Deadpool, for sure. Yeah.
I did read about Blade Trinity, and I read that poor old Wesley didn't like a lot of things that were in the script. And according to Ryan Reynolds, he spent a lot of his time in his trailer getting high on weed.
Oh, okay.
Which, who knows, may have affected the movie. But I thought that was interesting when I read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a scene in Blade Trinity, if you watch it, where his eyes look weird, and that's because, I can't remember what part of the movie it is, but there was a point where Wesley Snipes was so discontent with how things were going that he refused to open his eyes while they were filming.
Okay.
So they filmed it anyways, and then had to go back and use computer generation to put like fake open eyes on his face.
Wow. I mean, I thought you were going to piggyback on Frank's stoner comment and
going to say that you look at his eyes and you can tell he's so baked, man. Like, his eyes are red. They're
Well, I mean, maybe that's why he didn't open his eyes. He was just so done. But... Yeah. On the whole, I love the Blade trilogy. I think it doesn't get as much credit as it deserves.
Yeah, and I am wondering what the remake is going to be like, because Wesley Snipes is so associated with Blade.
Mm-hmm.
They did make a TV show with a different actor.
That's true, yes, I remember that.
I'm trying to remember when it ran. It was probably like in the early 2000s. It was basically along the same lines of the movies, but never really caught the popularity of at least the first two movies. So.
Oh, yeah, I found it right here, actually. I have my tablet with all my notes on it from the movie. I just found this. Aired on Spike in 2006. Sticky Fingers played Blade.
Yeah.
Lasted 13 episodes.
Which is funny, because like having someone like Sticky Fingers playing Blade, because I read that LL Cool J was actually in the running to play Blade in this movie. And that would have been like fucking bonkers, man. Like, I kind of like some of the stuff LL Cool J does, but I mean, you know, just, he's not Blade.
I think he would have had a good look, But he doesn't have, he wouldn't have had the martial arts prowess of Wesley Snipes.
That's true.
How well do you know the source material, Colin? Have you ever read the Blade comic?
I haven't dug deep on Blade in the comics. I've read some comics mostly that just feature Blade.
Okay.
But Blade's kind of one of those ones. He's never really had a full-on ongoing series that that has lasted for any amount of time.
Okay.
He kind of just has appeared. Like, I'm trying to remember when his first appearance was, but it was like probably in the 70s or 80s at some point.
Yeah, I think I read 70s somewhere.
Yeah, and then from the time that I've been collecting comics, he's mostly only appeared in cameos and then the occasional miniseries, but rarely ever. I think he had a brief ongoing series in around 2014 that only lasted 12 to 13 issues. So,
okay,
he's just unfortunately, even though the movies are so awesome, he's not a character that has ever really been able to break into the mainstream.
No, he's not a very mainstream character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is like not to take anything against Chadwick Boseman, but I always, like, when he passed away, people would always thought, like, oh, he was the first black superhero. And I always felt he's great and he's awesome and I love Black Panther and I love Chadwick Boseman and he's awesome, but I was always kind of like, but what about Blade? Like, people don't even think of him as a superhero. Yeah. So
what about Blade? What about, isn't Spawn black?
Spawn is black, yeah.
Yeah, and that came out before Blade. That was 97, that was 90, I think.
And, yeah.
And then what about Meteor Man? Huh?
Yes. How could we forget?
Maybe we should just scrap this whole episode and do Meteor Man.
Yeah. Oh, and also, wasn't the Green Lantern black at one point?
Well, in the comics, though, yeah.
Well, yeah.
I think they were specifically talking probably filmed black Superman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, Hitchcock was after this, so...
Hancock.
Hancock. What about Steel? Shaquille O'Neal?
Oh, yeah. I bet that predates Blade. That had to be, like, 96-ish. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
All right, you got
me. Let's stop putting it off. Let's do Blade here. Directed by Stephen Norrington, who has only three other directing credits, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Death Machine, and The Last Minute. He does also have several special effects credits. It's produced by, well, there are actually 10 producers listed. We've got Avi Arad and Stan Lee, of course, because it's a Marvel product. But from what I can tell, the three main ones are Wesley Snipes, who was also a producer on the big hit, all the Blade movies, Art of War, Undisputed. Basically, other than the big hit, it's just stuff that he stars in. It's also produced by Peter Frankfurt, who is a producer on The Boys, Juice, Lethal Weapon 2, all the Blade movies, and Robert Engelman, who is a producer on Mortal Kombat, The Mask, Mystery Men, Little Nicky, From Justin to Kelly. And it's written by David S. Goyer, who is the creator of shows like Krypton, Constantine, and the Blade series. But David Goyer also has consecutively some of the greatest writing credits and some of the worst. Like, he wrote all the Blade movies and Jumper and all the Christopher Nolan, Christian Bale, Batman movies. But then he's also the writer on Man of Steel and Batman v Superman and Ghost Rider 2 and Terminator Dark Fate. And Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., which we have mentioned before, is a David Hasselhoff movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to rip David Goyer a lot for Man of Steel, but then I heard he did an episode of the Nerdist podcast, which I recommend anybody who has beef with Man of Steel listen to, where I felt like he actually laid out why it is the way it is pretty good. It was a good defense of where he's coming from that I appreciated, so...
Yeah.
I'm going to give him a pass on that one.
So we open the movie on sound of thunder rumbling and a black screen with red letters. We're told it's 1967 and we watch as a pregnant woman is wheeled into an operating room bleeding from the neck. Eventually, we will find out she was attacked by a vampire, causing her to go into premature labor. Doctors are able to save her baby with an emergency C-section, but the woman dies of an unknown infection. A last minute shot of a wallet she drops shows that her name is Vanessa Brooks. Of course, I guess technically we're left to assume that she's dead at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
At least that's what I thought.
Yeah. That's a first time watch, I bet.
The scene switches to now with weird high-speed footage of the city turning from day to night. What city is this?
I'm pretty sure it's New York. I mean, well, if it
That's what I thought.
If it's based on the comics, I know that Blade is usually around New York, so I just kind of assumed it was New York.
Yeah. Okay.
It looked just like it to me, or at least I thought it was.
Yeah. See, and I thought maybe it was like L.A. or something. But then at the point where they kill the one vampire with the sunrise, that would mean that the sun is rising in the west.
Yeah.
So at one point I saw a calendar set to November, so it's definitely got to be somewhere warm though, right? Like something that's year-round warm if there's a November calendar? New York would be snowier.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did read something, and just I didn't notice this in the movie when I watched it, but apparently Blade is reading a New Orleans map at some point. So it's some ambiguous city, I guess.
Yeah.
I was going to say
America Town.
Yeah.
America Town. America Town, USA, yep.
The city of Townsville. Maybe, I don't know. You never know.
I was trying to remember the cop. I didn't take a look at what his patches were.
Oh yeah.
I just assumed it was New York, but
damn.
Yeah.
That would be the clearest tell.
Man. Well, we are following a couple cruising around in their car. It becomes pretty clear right away that they've probably only just met and they're all horned up. Like she grabs his crotch and he says, "That's my heat seeker." The guy here, kind of inconsequential, is credited though as Heat Seeking Dennis, which I thought was hilarious. I do remember this actor, Kenny Johnson, from an episode of Smallville, though. That's the only thing that I really know him from, but he doesn't matter anyway in the overall story. The woman is a bit more important. This is Raquel, played by Tracy Lords, best known as a porn actress, but has done some legitimate movies, too, like Crybaby and Zack and Miri Make a Porno, TV series like EastEnders, video game voice work. She actually has a lot of video game voice work. But, like, even when you look at her IMDb, most of her non-porno stuff still seems like almost porn. So the two of them pull up to a building and we are taken inside through a fucked up warehouse / slaughterhouse type area with a constant running commentary from Heat Seeking Dennis about what is this place? Where are we? What the fuck was that? They make their way through to a guarded door in the back, are let in, and enter an underground rave in progress, a rave club owned by Deacon Frost. We've got a DJ and sweaty people dancing and bearded Quinn over on a couch getting blown. This is played by Donald Logue? Is it Logue? Donald, yeah. Logue, who was in Ghost Rider, Max Payne 3, Three Ninjas, Knuckle Up, recurring roles on Vikings, Copper, Son of Anarchy, Life, ER, and, I mean, of course, we're on a comic book movie podcast right now. He was Harvey on Gotham. So I imagine a lot of people that like Blade probably watched Gotham at some point. Heat-seeking Dennis quickly gets separated from his date. I do like that she gives him her jacket and he just tosses it aside. He doesn't know what to do with it either. And he is left to wander the dance floor and try to fit in, which he very clearly doesn't. Everyone seems aggressive towards him. Raquel, meanwhile, has found her lady vampire friend Mercury, who is played by Argyle Jover, who, when you look at her IMDb, you see a lot of Spanish and French films with posters that have a lot of film festival stamps on them, you know, Palm d'Ors and shit, you know.
Oh, wow.
So she was also an imposter, the girl with the dragon tattoo, the Daniel Craig one, and Vampires Los Muertos, which I found interesting that she was in another vampire movie. While standing in the midst of this crowd, a drop of red liquid lands on Heat-seeking Dennis's hand, and I don't know about you guys, but whenever I'm in a strange place, my first instinct is to taste whatever falls on my hand, right? Is that just me?
I mean, not if it's falling from the sky.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it could be sweat, it could be, like, I mean, like, blood would be one of my last thoughts. I mean, you know, you can't tell what color things are with the lighting in that club, but
yeah.
I don't know that I'd taste it, but I'd probably smell it at least.
Yeah. Oh,
maybe, yeah.
And if it doesn't smell like Hawaiian punch, I just wipe it off.
So this is, of course, what he does just before the sprinklers get turned on and everyone on the dance floor gets showered in blood. And this awakes a ravenous urge in the crowd who all love this. But for old Dennis here, this has just gotten weird, so he tries to leave. But his plan to get out of there isn't going as planned because everyone there is now in a frenzy with teeth bared and preventing him leaving. He gets slightly curb-stomped and is trying to crawl away when he comes across an impeccably clean pair of boots standing at the edge of the blood-soaked dance floor.
Yeah, before we get into this, I feel like the blood flowing from the ceiling to me is just... I'm like, the excess of these vampires. That you have so much blood that you can just pour it from the sky. You know, I know that later on we find out that they have access to blood banks and all this stuff, but like, that's your food. That's like, I don't know, I wouldn't just rain hamburgers from the sky and be like, oh. Plus, blood is gross. Even if you're not just using it for eating, it's sticky.
It is, yeah.
I wouldn't want to be that sticky. It'd be like being covered with maple syrup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe this is a perfect opportunity to interject a little, like, public service announcement. 1-800-2-DONATE.
Make an appointment with Canadian Blood Services and donate blood, because obviously vampires are out there just wasting it to excess.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in the States, do it there too.
There you go. So the camera pans up, and we get our super dramatic, as it should be with any superhero movie. We get our hero reveal of trench-coated Blade, who is played by Wesley Snipes, who reprises the role in all three Blade movies. He was in Wildcats, Major League, The Fan, Jungle Fever, Art of War, Undisputed, The Expendables 3, Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and of course, as we talked about in Episode 8, Demolition Man. I did read that he was working on getting a Black Panther movie to the screen when this project came along. And
really?
Yeah, there could have been a Black Panther movie 20 years ago. I'm glad they waited for Chadwick Boseman. I'm so worried about what's going to come out of Black Panther 2 because he was amazing. People often forget, too, though, just how great he is in things like 42 and Get On Up. I mean,
you know, he's got
some great credits. But the blood stops pouring. The mood in the room quickly changes when everyone realizes the Daywalker is there. And I mean, all that's missing is a record scratch.
This scene is so perfect. Like, I started watching it, and I just, as I was watching, because I haven't seen the movie in a while, I was just remembering, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to happen. And it was so, it's just so good, the way the blood stops. Blade is there completely clean.
Uh-huh.
And then, yeah, the mayhem, so good. I love it.
And the one thing I really don't understand is, right, like, now he sets to work kicking all types of ass with his shotgun, Uzi's sword, and the coolest of all, the double-bladed boomerang. And all the people he kills disintegrates into flaming ash, but he gets through all this without any blood on him. Like, I understand that the vampires vaporize, mm-hmm. but he's fighting in the bloody room. Like, there's no splash up. Like, he walks away perfectly clean from all of this.
And they're all running past him on their way out, covered in blood.
Yeah, so there should be some sort of splashback or something.
maybe as part of his, like, preparation, he has some sort of spray that he puts on it to prevent any blood sticking on him.
I did read that the total body count in this movie is 88. So...
Really?
Yeah.
More than that. Especially in that first scene.
I had kind of forgotten how violent this movie is and also how R-rated it is.
Yeah.
I think just because I'm used to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and that kind of stuff. But I was surprised by just, A, how many heads get blown up, how many F-bombs are thrown around.
But I mean, we're desensitized now that Deadpool has been added to the MCU officially.
Yeah.
So, pandemonium in the club as people flee and some try to stand their ground against Blade. Ultimately, everyone who is stuck around is now dead, except for one, Quinn. And these guys obviously have a history. He shoots stakes at him, pinning him to the wall before setting him on fire. And at this moment, the cops and fire department burst into the club, and Blade has vanished. There was supposed to be a Stan Lee cameo right here, playing one of the cops, I read, and it was cut.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
So we cut to a hospital where we meet Dr. Curtis Webb performing an autopsy on the charred body of Quinn. He needs to get some advice from hematologist Karen Jensen, who is currently perplexed by the irregularities she sees in a blood sample from this supposedly dead body. And this is played by N. Boucher Wright, I actually went to Wikipedia to get the pronunciation of her name, because it's spelled like N apostrophe B U S H E. So yeah, it's N Boucher. I wanted to make sure that I got that one correct. And Boucher Wright has appeared in Dead Presidents, Fresh, Squeeze, Three Strikes, but she wasn't really in anything between 2006 and 2018. I guess they really wanted a white actress, but it was Wesley Snipes that pushed for a black actress for this part.
Good for him.
Good for him, absolutely, yes. Yeah. Especially when you look at like the fact that, except for Blade, were any of the other vampires black at all?
Vanessa.
Oh, yeah, well, and there's that little girl, too.
And there's the one pureblood vampire.
Was there? Okay.
One of the old, yeah.
That's right.
So he convinces her to come down to the morgue to help with the autopsy, but it seems he had a slightly ulterior motive because they used to be romantically involved, and he's trying to win her back in this, like, Melrose Place scene. I've actually read that they referred to it as the Melrose Place scene. They wanted to get this cut from the movie. This is when the charred body comes to life and straight up slaughters Dr. Webb with bites before turning his attention and feeding on Karen Jensen, enter Blade to try to save the fucking day and finish the job he started at the Rave Club. But before he can do any more than chop Quinn's arm off, Luke Skywalker style, the police show up to this disturbance and get in Blade's way, giving Quinn a chance to dive out the window to freedom.
Did either of you feel like the whole getting shot with stakes or lit on fire or cut by Blade's sword was wildly inconsistent in how the vampire on the receiving end would respond? Like, I was just thinking about the nightclub scene. There's points where he's just shooting people from probably 10 feet away, and they're like, they just get hit and they disintegrate. Yeah. Meanwhile, Quinn, you know, he takes two to the shoulders, cleverly aimed, and he's fine. He gets lit on fire. You know, he's on fire for a fair amount of time, and he's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It seemed at some points like certain vampires were more resilient than others.
Yeah,
like those stakes that he shot him with, you'd think they were silver. And it seems like anyone, as long as they're touched with silver, seems to disintegrate.
Yeah, like what's Raquel? Is that the... She gets the silver mace and her head explodes.
Yeah.
She doesn't even get the weird like coagulant shot.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I did read, though, that Donald Logue in this scene, he ended up falling. He had had like a jaw problem a few years earlier. And so when he did this scene, he hit his jaw and he ended up like wedging it open and having to go to the hospital.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. No.
Like, oh, I thought you were going to say he ended up fixing it by getting hit.
That's what I thought it was going to.
Yeah. So Blade needs to escape now, too, and he makes a quick decision with Karen bleeding from her neck and decides to take her with him, mostly because of flashbacks of his own mother dying. Like, is this a vampire thing?
Now that you mentioned that David Goyer wrote this film, is that right?
Yeah.
So this is very reminiscent of Batman vs. Superman with the Martha thing. Like, David Goyer has something, he has mommy issues, because it's like... He uses this whole mother pin as like the crux of people's monumental decisions in movies often.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This time it works. Batman vs Superman, I'd argue, it kills the entire movie. But
yeah, so with this incredible memory of being 1 minute old and remembering his mom dying, he has his own daring escape involving throwing Karen onto a nearby rooftop and then jumping after her with bullets ricocheting around him. And as he collects Karen, he pops her dislocated shoulder back in place and flees with her.
I remember seeing that. I was just like, Like, just imagine, like right there.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it happen before, but still, I didn't expect it to happen.
Yeah.
So Blade takes Karen to a safe house in a rundown factory where she is treated by his old friend and CCR listener, Abraham Whistler, who says, bringing home strays now? And he injects her with essence of garlic, but saying she's likely to not live through the night. Whistler is played by Kris Kristofferson, who reprises the role in all the Blade movies, like Frank mentioned up at the top. Spoiler alert, Planet of the Apes, the shitty 2001 Tim Burton version, Payback, Big Top Pee Wee, and of course, he's a singer-songwriter and former Army captain. I didn't know that about Kris Kristofferson, is that he was a captain in the Army.
Hmm.
Wow, I didn't know that either.
So we get to see the creepy headquarters of the vampires. I guess a boardroom of some sort?
That's what I thought. So, I thought it was interesting that they had their own boardroom.
Yeah.
And they had all that stuff. Like, I at first I was like, so they're, are they into politics? Or is it like just... I liked it, though. I thought it was a good kick.
Yeah.
This is the Council of Elders, and at the head of the table sits Dragonetti, who is played by Udo Kier, who has a ton of credits, but I know him best from Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. This is his third vampire that he's played, though. He was in Blood for Dracula in 1974, and this one's German, so I'm going to butcher it, Die Endsteiger in 1985. Dragonetti is busy flipping through photos of the Daywalker Blade, presumably photos from the club the night before, I guess, maybe?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
I think so.
When the owner of the club is let into the room, and as mentioned before, this is Deacon Frost, who is played by Stephen Dorff, who was in Judgment Night, Felon, Public Enemies, Bucky Larson, Immortals, True Detective, and music videos for Aerosmith's Crying, Limp Bizkit's Rollin', and Britney Spears' Every Time.
He was in the Rollin' video?
Yep.
Yeah, he's at the beginning with Ben Stiller.
Oh, that was him?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I gotta rewatch that now. No, it's funny for me, because this was the first time I saw Stephen Dorff in anything except a blue e-cigarette commercial.
Okay.
And he did those like 10 years ago. Stephen Dorff vaped before it was cool.
Wow.
Just saying.
There you go.
Like, that was back when vaping was an alternative.
Yeah.
Now it's a way of life. Yeah. And he did it way back then.
I read that Jet Li and Mark Wahlberg were also considered for the role of Frost, which that's an interesting mix.
Yeah.
Jet Li doesn't really fit in.
Yeah.
I could have saw Mark Wahlberg. Jet Li seems like a completely different, you're going a completely different way.
Well, there does seem to be a lot of Asian influence in this movie. So, I mean, maybe Jet Li would have fit in.
Well, I think that Jet Li would have fit in with the martial arts stuff. And, like, there's some Asian influence. I don't know.
Well, Deacon Frost saunters into the room and takes his seat halfway down the table. Serious question, though. Like, who is this guy? Like, why is he allowed to get away with being an insolent little shit?
Like, is there just something about honor among vampires or something? Like, you'd think that these other 20 stoic traditional vampires would just have this guy killed. Why do they put up with him? What's so special about Deacon Frost?
That's what I was trying to figure out too, because he was acting like just so juvenile.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do anything about it.
And his seat is halfway down the table, so he doesn't have a place of honor.
Right.
Yeah, they don't explain. They make a lot of references to him not being a pureblood and not being, you know, one of them.
Yeah.
But they don't really explain how he even got a seat at the table, which would be beneficial, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it that we had to read the comics first, or we just go right in?
Yeah, I wonder whether that's the case. Yeah, you'd at least understand more, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like you said, they even come out and say he's not even a purebred, but to keep the Harry Potter parallel going, Frost has a very Voldemort-esque plan to dominate the world by wiping out all the muggles, I mean humans. The world belongs to us, not the humans. We get a brief scene of Blade visiting a strange apothecary shop to re-up on his supply of the mysterious serum that we will soon have an explanation of, which he's building up a tolerance to, so it's not working as long, and he pays the guy in watches. I really like that their currency is whatever they can steal off the dead bodies. That's a great touch.
Yeah.
So back at the warehouse hideout, Karen wakes up and snoops around her new environment, including the wall of firearms and Blade's sword, where we get to see the booby trap on the handle for the first time. And I guess that's kind of an example of what you were talking about with it's selective how these things affect them, because obviously the blades on this are silver, which is why it vaporizes the one guy's hand later on, but it stops at the elbow. Like,
yeah.
Does tolerance only go that far in the arm for the vampire?
I guess so, yeah.
I did like them showing how the sword works so early.
Yeah.
Because I did notice as I watched the movie, every time somebody who wasn't Blade picked up the sword, I was like, oh. Like, I was just like, oh, is it gonna?
Here it comes, yeah.
And then even at the end when Frost has it, like, it shows that he actually knows the trick and stuff. So it was just a cool touch that kind of kept me into the movie a little bit more.
But in the subway scene, a few different people touch that sword, and the booby trap does not go off for a second time. So she manages to sneak a peek of Blade getting injected by Whistler, and but with his recently acquired serum, as they discuss how a hematologist and their crew could be useful. Man, Wesley Snipes makes that serum look painful, though, when he gets injected. Yeah. That looks like it hurts.
Yeah, he was shaking in the chair and everything. He was just, ooh. Yeah. Like, I even had to think, like, ugh. Like, I was just sitting there, just, like, looking at it. It's like, God. Yeah. What's in there?
Yeah.
So after the pain subsides, they spot Karen snooping. She tries to run, but even though Whistler has a bulky knee brace on, does the reason for his knee brace ever get explained?
Not in this move.
Okay.
I feel like it gets explained in one of the other ones.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he knows the layout of the warehouse better, and he manages to cut her off, and now she's cornered, and he introduces himself while Blade drops silently behind her. I love the silent drop.
Yeah.
If I could say something, I noticed that, and I really love the fact that literally every time he hopped in or came in somewhere, there was no sound whatsoever.
Yeah.
Every time. It just, and there he was.
Yeah.
I just thought that was the funniest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd be behind somebody. He'd be in front of somebody. Just no noise.
When I saw that, I was just thinking, like, there's no way a man that big has that. Like, he must have just ultra-cushioned shoes.
Yeah. So we cut to Whistler filling up Blade's car with gas and slopping gas all over and then lighting up a smoke, which was a fun sight gag moment. And he explains in the first of several exposition-y moments in this film that he and Blade have been waging a secret war against vampires using weapons based on their elemental weaknesses, such as sunlight, silver, and garlic, but crosses don't do shit. No mention of holy water either, I noticed.
They play down the religious aspect of vampire hunting quite a bit.
So as Karen is now marked by the bite of a vampire, both Whistler and Blade tell her to leave the city. Why is she marked? Like, I don't understand this marked business and why the rest of the vampires would care at all about this woman.
Yeah. The weird thing is that, to me, was that she was bit by Quinn, and Quinn never comes for her.
Yeah.
Like, generally, the way vampirism works is, like, it's like Siths. There's a master and an apprentice, so you, like, have your sire. And so that's the one who bit you, and it's like they have to come back and kind of like teach you the way. But he literally never, ever comes back, and nobody else knows who she is, it doesn't seem like. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense why any of them would really care about her at all. You would think they would just assume she was... Well, I mean, I guess they know that Blade took her. The cop does anyways, so that might explain it, but...
Yeah.
So Blade, meanwhile, is gearing up to go a vampire hunting. Blade will be dropping Karen off to pack her stuff to get out of there, but before she leaves, Whistler gives her what he calls vampire mace, which is a spray with essence of garlic and silver nitrate. He also gives her some advice. He doesn't think they were able to stop her infection in time. Buy a gun. If you start feeling sensitive to light, use it on yourself. So nice bleak goodbye from Abraham here.
He was so confident when he said it, too.
Just kill yourself, trust me. Upon returning to her apartment and now hyper aware that she lives in a world inhabited by vampires, Karen sees a couple of questionable people on the elevator with matching hieroglyph tattoos on their necks. She gets to her floor, feels like she's being followed by these two, but then she turns around with her mace. There's no one there. So she goes into her apartment and starts frantically packing because now she's a little freaked out. That's when a police officer by the name of Krieger enters her apartment under the pretense of a wellness check because she's a missing person now. But he ends up pulling his gun on her, so she uses her mace and sprays him. Turns out he's not a vampire, but rather a familiar, a human slave controlled by a vampire. Blade shows up because he was just using Karen as bait, and beats and subdues Krieger, and uses information from him to locate Frost in an archive that contains pages of the Book of Erebus, the Vampire Bible. So he hauls Krieger down to the street to give us the exposition required to understand a familiar's role in the vampire hierarchy, showing that he has bags of blood in his trunk and that he's kind of a courier for these vampires. But the cop busts free of him, and because the sidewalk is busy, Blade can't get a clear shot at him as he runs away. I love, though, that Blade pulling his gun gets pedestrians to scatter and scream, yet nobody is really giving the sword that he's carrying around on his back a second look at all. Like, in fact, when he puts the gun away, people just kind of go on about their business as usual, like, as if nothing just happened. But there's still this, like, scary dude there with this big old sword strapped to his back. I think I'd be crossing the street at that point myself.
Yeah. I mean, not to mention, like, the fact that he's also just dressed head to toe in black and with body armor and stakes, silver stakes on his leg.
I'm sure there's someone like that walking in New York City right now as we speak. And people are just walking past him, you know? It's just another day.
Dressed like Blade and not ironically.
And I just want to point out the subways in the SF Bay Area are just about the same way.
Yeah, okay. So Blade and his new unwanted sidekick, Karen, decide to stake out the cop's car. And when he comes back, I love Karen's line of, "No one's that stupid." They pursue him in a weird, fast-forwarded directorial choice. I don't understand some of the visual choices in this movie, I have to say.
Yeah.
We get some more exposition from Blade, some of it just a repeat from what Whistler told us earlier, in case we missed it the first time, and some of it talking about vampire safe houses and glyph markings, as they hide in an alley across from one of the safe houses, or weird Japanese panty club, whatever it is. He's also busy pointing out all the vampires to her. He can tell by the way they move and the way they smell. They enter this weird Japanese club. Like, I don't understand what is going on in this club. We have Japanese schoolgirls on stage singing, but it's got, like, strip club vibes, too. Is this what vampires are into? I do wonder, like, what is Wesley Snipes' obsession with Japanese culture? Like, I don't know the source material well enough to know if this is a Blade thing, but, like, I know that Wesley Snipes has a few movies like Art of War and Rising Sun where he leans heavily into it. Like, is it like Daniel LaRusso and Karate Kid basically adopting another culture as his own?
I don't think the cultural stuff plays as much of a role in the comics. Like, from what I know about the comics, he's just a straight up vampire hunter. So there would be more of like things around vampire lore and that type of stuff. But like all the kind of like Asian cultural appropriation it wouldn't really be there unless they were dealing with some sort of Japanese vampires or something like that, I don't think.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, they walk through this weird-ass club and end up finding their familiar cop coming out of the freezer. Blade roughs him up some more looking for Frost, but Frost isn't there. However, he does point out a secret passage behind one of the freezers. Blade lets him go to tell his boss that Blade is looking for him, and he and Karen head down the mysterious passageway. I will also say that they get into this very shiny elevator, which, though, is clearly not a real elevator because there's no gap in the floor. It's one of those things. They obviously built this set and didn't think about including like a little slot in the floor to make it look like a real elevator.
It's always the little things.
But they go down in the elevator and they find the high-tech archive. And then we cut to a very swanky penthouse apartment with a party going on. We see Quinn, who is no longer a charred corpse, but still looking rough, like he just went 10 rounds with Tyson, and a gloved hand, like Luke Skywalker. We find out that the penthouse is actually home to Deacon Frost, who is currently holed up in his bedroom with his computer trying to continue the translation of the Book of Erebus, which we had seen a bit earlier. And now the computer tells him the translation is complete. How cool is his bed, though?
Yeah. I was just going to say, what the fuck is up with that bed? That's a serial killer's bed.
But vampires sleep in coffins, so I understand that it must like, seal him off, right?
I guess. That's a good point. I don't know.
It's so much funnier now that you said that.
I just thought it was so odd that Vanessa seems to just live in the
bed.
She just lives in the bed. Yeah.
So his translation mission is complete. He shows practically no emotion over it and heads out to join everyone else. But Krieger the Familiar has crashed the party to pass on the ominous warning from Blade. And as a way to thank him for this information, Frost kills and eats Krieger. And now he's all, "Forget the girl, I want Blade." And we get a disgusting bloody kiss between Frost and Mercury licking blood off each other's face. And I mean, but yeah, so they're going after Blade, not the girl. And I mean, I still don't understand why they were so obsessed with Karen anyway. It makes no sense to me. But back to Blade and Karen in the secret passage where they come upon Pearl, a morbidly obese vampire who Blade calls the Record Keeper.
and they torture him with a UV light into revealing that Deacon wants to command a ritual where he would use 12 pure blood vampires to represent the 12 spirits. With the blood and the strength of all 12 spirits, it will awaken the blood god La Maigra, and Blade's blood is the key, the blood of a daywalker. And Karen at this point is kind of all in, though, eh? Like, she is enjoying torture so much. Like, so fucking much.
Yeah, to the point where Blade even kind of is like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, he moved. Her saying he moved is her dropping the mic. You know?
It just fried him.
He pissed me off. I'm just going to go to town. Oh, man. So Blade has found a vault door, and he uses some sort of explosive foam around the edge of it to blow the door open, and he has found the Vampire Bible. And the Bible room is kind of cool. Like, all those long pages suspended in glass panels.
Yeah, I thought that was cool, too.
Yeah.
I read that every one of those printouts cost $5 a piece for them to make.
Really?
Yeah, so add them all up, there's...
at least 100.
Yeah, just for the papers. And then how many times did they have to reset the glass and the paper? They spent thousands of dollars on these pages.
When I was watching that scene, I remembered... I thought that it was printed on human skin, but that must be from a different movie.
Maybe. Well, there is the one point where he says that it's at least written in blood, where Whistler looks at it and says it smells like a vampire wiped his ass with it, but says that it's blood. Well, the bad guys have formulated a plan to ambush Blade because they know where he is, but they're under orders to bring him in alive. And just like Julia Roberts said to the shop clerk that refused to give her service in Pretty Woman, big mistake.
Yes.
Huge. Because Blade at this point kicks a whole bunch of glass. Huh? Huh? See what I did there? He's throwing them through the pages of the Bible, knocking them around, and although they manage to temporarily capture him by tying him to a pillar with a wire around his neck in what appears to be a well-executed tactical strike, and they have Karen held hostage, he gets out of it after he's been staked a couple times as payback from our friend Quinn, but he says, "I'm expecting company." And enter Whistler with the line, "Did I catch you fuckers at a bad time?" Oh, before unleashing a barrage of ammunition down upon them, mowing them down, the vault gets blown up in the process, and it turns into a chase now as Quinn goes after Blade, and we get a very exciting battle in a subway tunnel where they are fighting and dodging what have to be the longest subway trains ever. Like, every time one of those trains goes by, it's like 15 cars long.
Yes. It just kept going and going.
Yeah. Ultimately, Quinn escapes after losing another hand, and Blade gets Karen to safety inside a subway car, and now it's Karen's turn to fix Blade's dislocated shoulder, and watches he injects more serum. And then we go back to the warehouse hideout and listen to more exposition. This time it's Whistler telling Karen Blade's backstory about what makes him different from regular vampires. The fact that he was born from a mother who was bit. So we also finally learn what the serum he keeps injecting is, something to keep his bloodlust under control. And of course, the tragic backstory of Whistler's dead family and why he hunts vampires. No mention of his leg injury, though. I still want to know that story. Plus, we ominously find out that Frost is planning something big. So Karen goes to find Blade with this newfound knowledge, who is kind of sulking now, and she stops being a hematologist, but instead a psychologist, as she listens to Blade discuss his hunting to avenge his mom and in Wesley Snipes' big drama moment. This is his Oscar speech moment.
Yeah.
You know, had Blade been nominated for...
Yes.
We cut to Frost sitting in a car, meticulously putting on sunblock. Turns out he and his inner crew have abducted Dragonetti. So this is what I was saying that the other guy should have done to him in the first place for just being a little shit. You know, they've abducted Dragonetti. They've taken him to a beach to watch the sunrise. Obviously, because he's a vampire, this isn't going to go well, but you know, that's kind of the goal, because the younger group of non-pureblood vampires is ready to overthrow the purebloods. It's a mutiny, and they defang him, and then Dragonetti explodes in a glorious fireball, while the rest of the gang, wearing tinted motorcycle helmets, watch on.
I don't understand this sunblock.
Yeah.
This is something I have, like, made, like, it gets even worse, I think, the scene next when they're actually talking to Blade in broad daylight without motorcycle helmets.
Yeah.
But it was like, okay, I could buy the sunblock for, like, oh, we just need it to protect ourselves in the early light before the full sun is out, and then we need to put on our helmets, which, I mean, they should be, like, welding helmets, not just motorcycle-tinted helmets.
Right.
Yeah.
But then later on, when they're just, like, full view, covered in sunblock, like, I don't know. It goes against everything I know about vampire lore. The suggestion that and what about his scalp? Like, did he put sunblock all in his scalp? And, like, you would have to literally dip yourself in sunblock for this be feasible.
Don't your eyeballs count as skin?
Like, yeah. And at the same time, it's about, there's, like, a magical supernatural aspect to it. It's not about the sun, like, literally just burns. Like, your skin can no longer take the sun and it burns you off. It's about, like, you're a creature of the night. You're not allowed to be in the day. Even if most vampires, even if you were wearing sunblock, you would still burn. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a real bone of contention for me in this movie.
Yeah, him putting on the sunblock reminds me of the first Batman movie when whenever Joker paints his face skin tone.
Right.
So back at the warehouse hideout, Karen has basically moved in at this point and stolen a bunch of lab equipment from her hospital. She's experimenting with the anticoagulant EDTA as a possible replacement for the serum, but discovers that it explodes when combined with vampire blood. I did notice here that she takes some of Blade's blood without tying him off first. Another one of those details that's a little annoying to me. Looks like the good guys have just found a new weapon to use, though. Karen is confident that she can cure Blade's bloodthirst, but it would take her years of treating it. We also get yet more exposition about Whistler and the fact that he's dying from cancer, and the dreary realization that Karen probably only has a couple days left before she turns too. So she sets to work trying to synthesize a vaccine.
What a bunch of downers.
Yeah.
That's all I could think of that part.
I heard that the ending was that the blood god was going to win, and, like, a wave was going to go over the entire city, and everyone was going to turn to vampires. Like, it was supposed to end on an apocalyptic ending.
And really?
They weren't sure whether there would actually be a sequel, so that was scrapped, but...
I honestly feel like that would have set up even better sequels.
Yeah.
Like, Blade is the perfect character to be kind of... like I Am Legend, like just the last man, in a fallen world.
Yeah, you know, I heard that's kind of similar to how they were going to end Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah,
because the Broadway musical ends with the plant eating everybody.
Yep.
But then in the movie, Frank Oz, well, actually they filmed the whole ending with that, and Frank Oz, who directed it, went through preview audiences and they said how much they hated that ending because they all died. So he had to reshoot it and rewrite it and all that stuff. But you're right, Colin, about that, him being the only Daywalker left in a world of vampires. That would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. There's a few movies that I think would have... It's like the happy ending almost kind of ruined the movie.
That's interesting that you say that, too, about the movie, because I never thought of that, and I know the musical Little Shop of Horrors fairly well, and, like, the closing song of the musical is something where it, like, narrates the bleak future that's about to come of the plants taking over. So there is actually a song in the original Broadway version, so I've just never really noticed that with the movie, but I love Rick Moranis, and I'm glad they caught that guy. No one punches Rick Moranis.
Yes.
Blade, now on one of his patrols of the city, ends up finding Frost, or maybe Frost found him might be the better way of putting it.
Yeah.
With his weird little mind whisper to Blade. So he holds a young Asian schoolgirl hostage so that Blade won't attack him. Frost is a little jealous of Blade being a Daywalker because he has all the same strengths, but none of the weaknesses. Because obviously Deacon Frost doesn't see bloodthirst as a weakness, I guess. But I'd say that's the same weakness as an actual vampire, though.
Mm-hmm.
Frost is offering a truce between them. Blade, of course, is not having any of that shit. Blade can see that Frost's sunscreen is starting to run, and Blade attempts to shoot Frost, but he dodges very Matrix style. And Frost has to get out of there, so he throws his hostage across the fucking park and into the street where she is in danger of being run over by a bus. Quick decision time. Go after Frost or save the girl. Well, Blade is a true hero and chooses the latter, saving the little girl just in time and telling her to go home.
When I was watching the scene, at the point where Blade tells Frost that his makeup's starting to run or whatever, I just thought to myself, somebody missed out on an opportunity to make an epic Rudy Giuliani meme. Like, I was just like, if you took that picture of his hair dye running down his face and just put Blade on the bottom. the guy basically looks like a vampire.
Yes.
But you know what, Colin? There was one other thing I saw in that park before Frost threw the girl. I saw a student walk by wearing a JanSport backpack, so I think it's time to slip in Sponsorship Corner!
Wow, it's been so long that I thought maybe you just forgot.
Nope.
But here we go.
Here we go. Always on the lookout for product placements. Blade has very few, but I found a handful. Blade is brought to you by JanSport, Black Fly Sunglasses, Miller Lite, KP Steel, Atlas Auto and Exhaust, the movie Mortal Kombat, because when Krieger dies, that's playing on the TV in the penthouse, and Blade's very sexy black 1968 Dodge Charger. It's a couple years earlier than Dom's and Fast and the Furious, but I'm pretty sure Blade also lives life a quarter mile at a time. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
I love that. That was good.
I'm looking forward to Fast 9 in space. So Frost, after running away, has managed to infiltrate Blade's hideout before he gets back. He and his goons ambush Whistler and kick his ass, spit on him, that's just disturbing when he just spits on Whistler, and leave him for dead as a message to Blade. Blade returns to the hideout to find Whistler in a chair covered in a bloody sheet with a videotape nearby. Whistler, it turns out, is still barely alive enough to warn Blade that going after him is dangerous. And I love that Blade here, he pulls out, like, the tiniest piece of gauze and like starts dabbing at Whistler's wounds with
it. The guy's like, what are you doing? He's dying. Why are you even bothering?
It's just a little square of gauze. It's like, well, yeah, sure, that'll help.
So every little bit. Maybe just a little here, a little there, maybe.
It's just a flesh wound.
It's like The Simpsons where Homer thinks he's dying and he teaches Bart to shave. And then he's like, you shave here, here, here. And then you grab a little piece of toilet paper and put it here and here and anywhere else you're bleeding. We've got the same thing happening here. The exposition, though, that we get from Whistler as he's dying, they need his Daywalker blood to carry out their vampire apocalypse plan of resurrecting the blood god. You're the Keyblade. You're blood. You're the chosen one. If Frost gets his hands on you, it's over.
There's only one thing to do, all that said. Run to Frost. Run right into his hands.
Exactly. But not before Whistler begs Blade to kill him because he's been bitten and he doesn't want to become a vampire, but Blade can't do it. So Whistler demands that Blade leave his gun so he can do it himself. And Blade does and walks away. We hear a bang and a close-up of Whistler's hand dropping the gun. The end of Whistler. Unless you've seen the sequels. Blade watches the videotape, which is calling Blade out, and of course, to sweeten the threat, they have Karen as well. We need a damsel in distress. Now it's mini-montage time of Blade gearing up for his hunt by smelting bullets and filling vials of EDTA and pulling the cloth off his motorcycle and meditating, you know, stuff like that. And it all ends with him pulling a plant out of a pot and very dramatically slicing the roots of it off with his sword. What?
I did not understand what was happening.
I didn't either.
I was like,
yeah. It's like,
yeah, I don't know. I'm at a loss. I was just like, oh, Blade is all, he's just taking a break for a herbology lesson or something like that. I don't know. Like, yeah.
It's supposed to symbolize the fact that Whistler just died and he's cutting his roots to, like, I don't know.
Well, I thought maybe he was making some serum or something, but I don't know. It's just a weird aside as far as I could tell.
So we cut back to Frost's penthouse, where Karen is kind of egging on Frost to get under his skin, bragging about her cure and attacking his Achilles heel, his pure blood status. And she's calling vampires a virus. And then he responds with a pretty melodramatic speech about his plan to take over the world with dramatic music scoring this moment. Mm-hmm. It's a little cheesy compared to everything we've just seen. But when his plan plays out, it won't matter who's pure blood and who's not. But oh shit, they have an intruder downstairs. All of Frost's henchmen line up to deal with it, and we hear a motorcycle revving. I like, he has the line of something like, you know, it's just one man by himself.
It's just one man on foot.
Yeah, one man on foot. That's what the line is. Yes, that's why the fact that he's on a motorcycle is hilarious. Blade cuts through all these guards easily in some pretty awesome fight choreography, and also using his new anticoagulant as a weapon too. I'd say the vampire effects of them exploding are a little on the weak side, though.
They were running out of CGI money at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, because the fight with Frost coming up is also one that's a little hard to watch.
Yes. But I will say, you know, I did love, well, I'm not sure if it's too late to say this, but I did love every aspect of CGI in this movie.
Yeah.
Especially for coming from 1998.
Yeah. Because
here it is.
Yeah.
I was thinking, because this was 3 years after Toy Story, which is like the first full-length computer film. Mm-hmm. And this movie, 20 years ago, had better CGI than Cats.
Yeah. Oh.
I lost all hope in CGI when I saw that trailer.
My wife pointed out there's a lot of influence, I think, of Blade in the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they look very similar, and even some of the CGI, there's the whole bullet thing with Frost that's very reminiscent of the Matrix. So, it definitely, I mean, you always forget there was a time before CGI, and so it's interesting sometimes watching movies like this where you can see it's still in its infancy, but it's not as bad as you'd think.
Mortal Kombat was rougher in a lot of the places, that's for sure. Yeah. So Frost throws the building into lockdown. Blade makes his way into the boardroom and finds that super cool bed, which opens up and reveals, bum, 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 Blade's mother. Twist! I like that we find out that Blade's real name is Eric.
It
seems so soft.
Who the fuck?
Yeah, he looks more like a T-bone or a, I don't
know. or a blade. I think I think that one kind of nailed it right on the head there. Not Eric. Well, she could have found out that, or we could have found out his name was like Gavin or like Connor or something.
Charlie. I don't know.
Well, she reveals that she came back to life the night that she was attacked and was brought in by Frost, who appears and reveals himself as the vampire who bit her. Well, his mother being alive is enough of a distraction that they're able to start tasing Blade and subduing him. Blade, in desperate need of serum, is then taken with Karen in the back of a truck to the Temple of Eternal Night, where Frost plans to perform the summoning ritual for La Magra. Frost takes a moment to throw what he thinks is Blade's serum away. That'll come back. Quinn steals Blade's sunglasses. Frost teases that he's going to cut off Quinn's arm with Blade's sword. And this is the moment you were talking about where he knows how to turn off the booby trap. But that was a very funny moment where he's like, come on, man, I just grew it back. And Karen is thrown into a pit to be devoured by her ex-boyfriend slash colleague Webb, who has transformed into a decomposing zombie-like creature. Did I miss why?
they briefly talk about it as they're bringing her to the pit, but it's not really explained why. It's not explained what caused that to happen to him.
Yeah,
well, I felt the same way.
Yeah. Because you expect him to be a vampire,
but
it's like being thrown into the Rancor pit in Return of the Jedi. I mean, it's this creature down there, not a vampire. But Karen injures Webb with a sharp bone and escapes. She's such a badass. Like, to go from being a doctor a night ago to now she's torturing Pearl and stabbing her ex-boyfriend with a bone. Like, meanwhile, Blade is put into this weird Han Solo-esque carbonite-looking contraption. All I know is that looking at this, if Blade figurines didn't come in packaging that looks like this thing,
that was a huge missed opportunity. Like, it's yeah. like
to bring Toy Story back into it. It's like the packing foam in Toy Story 2 when the toy guy, Al, he's packing up the toys and he's got
the foam cases. Right. Yeah.
But, you know, it would have also been great if there were, like, giant twist ties, not belts, holding Blade in place here.
But that's all I could see was an action figure. Right.
But he is weak because he's busy trying to fight his bloodlust. It's been too long since his last dose of serum. His mother comes in completely on Frost's side, and we get this weird moment of, like, sexual tension between mother and son. Was I the only one that got that vibe from that scene?
I got it, too.
Okay. Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, I was just sitting there like,
It's a very Oedipal moment. Gave me sure.
Manchurian Candidate vibes. You ever read that book?
No.
Something similar like that happens. Moving on.
Okay.
All right. I'll watch the movie.
Which version? Because there's the Denzel remake.
Well, definitely the Denzel one. But...
Yeah. But Blade isn't willing to join them, so they need to take his blood by force, with knives digging into his wrists as the other side of this action figure packaging closes in on him. And then below, in the main chamber, the Vampire Council has been meticulously placed around the outside of the big circle with Frost on a plinth in the center. I don't understand, though. Like, one of these council elders gets slaughtered by Mercury for being sassy. Yes. So, like, with one less body for this ritual... Is it still going to work properly? It seemed like it was very necessary to have 12.
Did it still come out of the dead guy? I'm trying to remember. Because...
Oh, the skeleton at the end.
What was it, like like a Notre Dame gargoyle or something like yeah. that? Coming out of their mouth.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if was it the dead guy part of it. Because, yeah, that's only 11 now.
Yeah.
Like, unless somebody took one for the team and went for it.
That's some sloppy... ritual work that Frost has going on, letting his henchmen slaughter people.
Yeah.
Well, the blood from Blade starts going through special channels and decorative symbols on the ceiling and walls, where it ends up distributed over the heads of each of the council members and dripping on them. Meanwhile, Karen has found Blade and somehow easily figures out how to open this carbonite box and releasing him. He is drained of his blood, but Karen allows him to drink from her, enabling him to recover. And so, I mean, there's no actual sex scene in this movie, but him drinking from her is pretty close.
That's the closest we're gonna get.
Yeah, it's the raunchiest, I don't know, drinking I've ever seen. It's, I don't know.
Yeah, there's so much thrusting.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know what's...
Right.
I don't know what's happening here.
So back in the main chamber... The final stage of the ritual takes place with blood pooling in the center of the ceiling symbol thingy with some more pretty rough CGI. And lightning strikes with the skeletons of the purebloods climbing out through their mouths, which is also some rough CGI. But they tried really hard. And Frost completes the ritual and obtains the powers of Lamegra. But Blade confronts Frost after killing all of his minions, including Blade's mother, and finally Quinn, so he gets his sunglasses back. But he's pissed! Blade and Frost get their fight on! Why are there sparks coming off their swords?
I don't know, because it's cool. I love how he, like, just kills Quinn with that zip wire. Yeah. Like, that scene where he kills him and then catches the glasses is... So yes. Iconic.
I love mind. That too.
So awesome. And I mean, I don't know. This movie to me reminded me that all I really need in a movie to make it worthwhile is a good sword fight. Even if it's just like two minutes. That's all I need.
So we see that Frost can instantly heal now that he is one with the Blood God and in some more rough CGI. Karen is also fighting Mercury and finishes her off with the vampire mace to the grill, making her head explode. And the syringes of blood serum that were thrown away by Frost that are actually anticoagulant come back into play. I love, though, how he throws his sword and Frost says, like, nice shot, or you missed, or whatever it was. But it's the Blade booby trap on the handle that makes the rocks break open and get him his anticoagulant. And then he does that cool catch behind his back.
Yeah.
did you skip over the sweet scene where he, like, cuts Frost in half And then you have the like silent close up on Blade's face where he's like, "What the fuck?" And he's
I kind of skip past it, but I mentioned it, but just as the rough CGI of him automatically healing, But Blade injects Frost with all of the syringes, causing his body to inflate and explode, killing him. And Blade has his line, a really iconic line, which I honestly don't understand in this context, but where he says, "Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill." Like, it's fun, but I don't get it. Like, I really don't get it. Am I just, you know, an idiot?
Let's think.
I also sat there like, oh, wait, what? it was cool in the moment.
Yeah.
But then I didn't think about it, like, ice skate.
I mean, the moral of it, I guess, is like people always want to do things the hard way.
Yeah.
But I don't know how fraught, like.
Yeah.
It's like saying you could have just been cut in half, but instead I had to explode you.
Yeah.
I don't know. I did want to point out, I was just thinking about this morning after watching the movie last night, but it's weird to me, like, L'Magre is a blood god. Mm. Like, an all-powerful blood god. What is it about this coagulant serum? Like, yeah, it works on all these normal vampires, but why couldn't he just reconstitute himself again? It's not really explained in any way why exploding him was the magic button that did it.
Yeah, because...
Again, he's a god.
Yeah, and he can instantly heal when he's cut in half. I mean, exploding, that's just a whole bunch more pieces, but it's still just pieces. You're right.
Yeah, it would take a little while longer, but it would still come together.
Yeah.
It kind of... Now that you said before about how the original ending was L'Magre was going to win... This scene kind of made a little bit more, like, it seems more like it was just thrown together last minute.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, I mean, if L'Magre does win, then in the sequels, Blade has the opportunity to figure out, what do I actually need to do to beat him, you know?
But another thing I read about the ending originally is that he was supposed to just turn into, like, this gelatinous blob of blood. Yeah, so the fact that they added it in as a sword fight between him and... like a physical Frost, that was something that was a late addition to this movie.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So we get denouement time in this movie, and there's still a war going on. If you want to help, make me a better serum. And then we get a brief epilogue where Blade confronts the vampire in Moscow, making this movie a little cliffhangery, and the end.
Yes.
And that is Blade. Now, Colin Frank, on IMDb, it scored a 7.1 out of 10, has a Metascore of 45. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 56 on the tomato meter, and an audience rating of 78%. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Give me some reviews.
All right. Well, yeah, the critics hated this movie, unfortunately, but I love it, so I definitely leaned more on the positive reviews.
Yeah.
So, the first one we have is from Google Play. It's J.L. Jones. This was written in 2015. That's important.
Okay. But I'll get to it after. So he says,
"Great action. Snipes puts in a great performance as the Marvel Daywalker half-human, half-vampire. I personally look to Blade as the movie that kicked the adaptation of comic book characters being feature-length movies into high gear, not to diminish Todd McFarlane's Spawn in any way. As I'm writing this review in 2015, Snipes and Marvel have been having dialogue about there being a new Blade movie, or Marvel finding some way to bring Blade back into the MCU, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., perhaps."
Hmm.
Okay. I thought that was just interesting just because it's like...
I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's just a crazy how far we've even come from 2015 with, like, the net... I would have expected Blade to be a part of the Netflix Marvel shows eventually if they had kept on going, but
yeah.
I mean, all those shows are more, compared to the movies, they're more in line with, I guess, the tone that I think Blade could have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I find it funny though, or interesting, that a review written in 2015 references only Spawn in that as, you know, for what was it, for Dark Heroes it said or whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think he was talking about hero movies before, which is another interesting thing, because I have another review that I'm going to talk about later. But in my mind, Blade is kind of the beginning of the superhero genre. Mm-hmm. Like, even I watched Spawn and I enjoyed Spawn, but I felt that movie was always kind of campy. Like, Blade to me was the first superhero movie that was like kind of serious, because after Blade then comes X-Men, And then after X-Men comes Spider-Man and Daredevil, Fantastic Four, and all those ones that are kind of truer to the comic book source that yeah. people would know. But I'll talk about that after. The next one I have is from Douglas Payne. He says, "This is the movie that made Marvel what it is today, an R-rated, gory-filled, often dark movie that was a winning combo, along with the perfect actor for the role and a non-origin story has me watching this over and over again. They didn't recreate that until Deadpool, and see how much of a success it was, Marvel. Take notes. My only gripes with this movie is the dated special effects, sometimes poor acting, and cheesy dialogue, but it's still better than most of the Marvel movies out there."
When was that one written?
This was from 2019.
Okay. Shoot.
It brings up a good point that I often say now is I feel like the superhero movies need to do away with the origin story movie. Like yeah. you can always just throw it in like flashbacks, but I don't need the origin story to be the entire movie.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, and now we'll go to the actual critics reviews. So David Kerr with the New York Daily News says, "Has the comic book movie reached the end of the line?" Again, this was written in 1998. "The glumly familiar been there done that aspect of Blade certainly suggests so." And so what superhero movies? I don't remember there being that many superhero movies other than Batman, I guess, before Batman? 1998.
Yeah. Yeah, Batman and
yeah.
Well, I mean there was the
Supermans.
The Dolph Lundgren Punisher.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, not very good yeah. ones. Yeah.
And I mean, that, I wonder what that person thinks now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the last one I have is from Michael Wilmington with the Chicago Tribune. He said, "Blade is often ridiculous, mostly poorly written," poor David Goyer, "and surprisingly poorly acted, too."
Let's see, and I did point out the one moment where Stephen Dorff was a little over the top, but I don't think anyone else gave a really bad performance at all.
No.
Yeah, I thought Blade was weirdly inconsistent at times. Like, anytime he did... Like, for example, when he spikes Quinn to the wall and then he does the arm pump.
Yeah.
I thought that was a bit weird, but but overall, I think, like, Wesley Snipes was perfectly cast. I can't imagine another person being Blade.
Yeah, especially LL Cool J.
Yeah.
Right on. So there we go. We've got, like I said, 45 and 56 from critics, 7.1 and 78% from audiences. Frank, it's your first watching of this movie. What did you think of your first experience with Blade?
Honestly, I did enjoy it. You noticed that the CGI was very, I didn't notice until we were talking about it, it was very good at the beginning of the movie, then it started to kind of dwindle a bit. But still, I was very impressed by that aspect, especially mm-hmm. with the budget they had and the technology they had back then. I do think everybody put a really good performance. Like, I loved Chris Christopherson. He did. I loved his character, his portrayal of Whistler. Stephen Dorff could have been, like you said, over the top sometimes. He was just a dick in general. But he played it to a T, because, you know, when you really hate the guy and you want to go into the movie and punch him, like,
yeah,
that's how you know they're playing a good character. And I just loved Wesley in it. But I enjoyed it. Like, yeah. Honestly, like, I don't think I'm going to be, like, obsessed with the movie forever and ever. But, I mean, for my first time watching it, because for me, I don't watch a lot of superhero films. Like, I'm, like, into really old movies. Like from way back, like 40s and 50s film noir and things like that. Okay. But like, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I know your theme song is for your podcast. It definitely shows what kind of era you belonged in. You know, you're an old soul, aren't you?
You could say.
Yeah. Colin, Blade, you still love it?
Yep. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I don't know. Just from... This movie was, like, comfort viewing to me. Like I said, I haven't watched it in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as it started, as soon as that club music hit, and I was like, oh, I know it's about to go down, and then you see Blade show up, and then it's just, like, the thing, they don't make a lot of movies like this that are just nonstop the whole way through. Like, that's what I appreciate. I don't know what it says about me, but I love violence. I love violent movies. I love the martial arts, the sword fighting, the people getting blown up and sliced up, like... It's just, and it just, from the time you see those boots and the pool of blood to the very last, you know, sword fight and the kicking the needles in Deacon Frost's head, yeah. Like, the movie just never really lets up at all. And
yeah.
I liked it. I still, yeah. still like it a lot. It's still one of my favorite movies. Like I said, I think this, even the current... Marvel like movies now like owe a lot, like I think the whole superhero movie genre owes a lot to Blade, because it was the first
it was one of the first ones that was taken really seriously, because you had the Tim Burton Batman movies and they were dark and serious. But 95, 97, you had the Schumacher Batman movies, and I think that took us like 50 steps back.
Yeah.
So then we had Blade right at the course and took us to where we are now.
Yeah, definitely did. Yeah, I mean, I noticed on this watch, I obviously mentioned it a few times, I found it much more exposition heavy than I remember. And with your comment earlier about they should do away with the origin story, I mean, there was definitely some moments in this for me that dragged a bit. But yeah, the action was still, it was high octane, it was fun, it was exciting. And yeah, I mean, this is still probably like an 80% movie for me, you know, even after 20 years.
Really the only critique I would have of the movie now is, like, and this is just being older, I think, and expecting more from movies, is even though Deacon Frost is kind of a, what's the word you keep using? He's kind of a brat.
Yeah.
I think that this movie could have benefited a lot if they would have explained him a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, where he comes from and what his backstory is and how he got to where he is. And that would have done a lot to help explain why he wanted to do all the things he does. Like, his whole purpose in the movie is kind of lost.
Yeah.
Because it's not really ever explained. So I think I would love to see a version of this movie that kind of maybe goes back and explains him a little bit more.
Yeah,
because they just jump right in and assume he's the bad guy. Maybe he's the good guy. We don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there we go. That is Blade, and that is our show for this week. Now, a big thank you to our special guest, Frank Driscoll. It's been a blast having you on our show today, Frank.
Yeah, man, you're awesome.
I had a blast. Thank you.
I'm glad. If people want to find you out there on the old interwebs, where can they find you?
Well, the podcast is called Frankfully Honest. There are new episodes every Thursday at 8 a.m. Eastern, 5 a.m. Pacific time. So depending on where you are in this zany world of ours, I'm sure you'll be able to find a time where you can listen. And it's a very short program, so if you don't like it, it'll be over before you know it. And also, you can follow our program both on Instagram and Twitter at FrankfullyCast. That was the shortest handle I could get without all the other good ones being taken. So there you go.
Yes, like you said, it is a very short format podcast. I enjoyed binge listening to his entire catalog, and it took me an hour to get through it. It's, you know, if you've got 90 minutes to kill, you can listen to our show and Frank's at the same time. Yeah, it's a really fun concept. Why did you choose to do the such a short format?
Well, you know, I took a class in college, right? I just graduated from San Francisco State University, and I took a class last fall, and it was about short form media. I majored in broadcasting communication arts, and this class was mostly about scripted web series. Okay. And, like, you know, like 10-minute episodes and things like that. And as I was researching through items to write about, things like that, I kind of realized how influential short format is getting, because also at this time they announced that platform Quibi, which sadly is not around anymore. They announced that at the time, and then I had a feeling for a second that this is starting to kind of grow. And plus, I was always a big fan of Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes.
Okay, yeah.
Here in the United States. Yeah. He'd spend his last 3 minutes of the program just talking about whatever the hell he wanted. Yeah. And also, I listen to a lot of, you know, short stuff here and there, so that's kind of where inspiration came from me. So this was kind of out of my comfort zone, because my commentaries are often written ahead of time and things like that, so I had to go, like, on the spot here. But And I thank you guys for bringing me on. I really had a great time.
I don't know. I'm interested to listen to, because I think the short form podcast, I've never really seen one or heard one before. But I definitely know that there are times where I feel like my attention span isn't long enough to sit through an hour and 90 minutes. So I think you've got a niche market there.
Well, if you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to tell your friends, share our posts. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast trying to get noticed in the huge sea of shows out there. Or if you want to go above and beyond to help us out, go to whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't really matter what you say, but it's those 5 stars. They just drive us up the charts and they just help us get noticed.
And do us a favor and check out our website, www.iuselikethisone.com. There you find links to all our podcast episodes as well as our social media. You can check us out on social media. We have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just search I Used to Like This One. Look for our logo. I'm sure you'll find it. Check out all our content. Like our posts, comment, share with your friends. Let them know what's up.
And then hopefully we'll have more people come listen to us, and you guys all can talk about it and be friends, and you can tell us how you met friends on our website and our Facebook group. It'll be good times. Come join the I Used to Like This One community.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and get a shout out and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
Thanks for coming, Frank.